Black Agenda Radio with Glenn Ford and Nellie Bailey. Mondays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, will return next week. Coming up, former Georgia Congresswoman and presidential candidate Cynthia McKinney talks about U.S. war crimes. Greens and occupiers demand that the broadcast spectrum be handed over to the people. And Jared Ball says, whatever you do, don't go to see Clint Eastwood's movie on J. Edgar Hoover. But first, Mumia Abu-Jamal will no longer face the death penalty, but his supporters say the authorities are still out to kill him. Seth Williams, the Philadelphia district attorney, has dropped his bid to seek Mumia's execution in the death of a Philadelphia policeman 30 years ago. However, Pam Africa of the International Family and Friends of Mumia smells a setup.
This is a devious trick of theirs to get them in general population where they can kill Mumia, and we're exposing this worldwide. We're not fooled by the tricks of this government, and because this is the same government who attempted the assassination of Leonard Peltier. This is the same government and all that executed, murdered George Jackson, and the list goes on and on of political people who have been in the clutches and the hands of these people in these prisons, and they attempted to assassinate and assassinated people. They're not mincing their words. And one cop said, I can't wait till he get in general population. In general population, this is where they can take him out at. And I'm saying, anytime these cowardly people behind the fact that they cannot execute Mumia the same way that they executed Shaka Sankofa, and we will never forget his murder, the same way they executed Zion Israel in Indiana, the first Black Panther to be executed, the same way that they executed Tookie Williams despite evidence of innocence, they executed these people. But Mumia's case is so worldwide that you got presidents of countries. Bishop Desmond Tutu just issued a statement telling Seth Williams the only thing that can happen here in dealing with the case of Mumia based on innocence is to release Mumia. But I'm saying, again, we want to stress to people, Mumia must be released from the clutches of these people based on evidence, factual evidence that nobody can get around, prosecutorial misconduct, judicial misconduct, and the fact that they just want to kill Mumia. This is like a win game for them. Behind the fact that they can't do it one way, they feel as though that they'll win and do it another way.
Back in 2001, the threat of the death penalty was lifted by a judge, and you noted that lots of Mumia supporters who were death penalty opponents thought the struggle was over then.
Well, the majority of them stepped back a long time ago, and we have continued because, see, the anti-death penalty movement is not responsible for Mumia being a worldwide figure and a worldwide opposition to the death penalty. They didn't start it, and they will not end it. I'm saying despite that, people are coming from around the world. Despite them stepping back from Mumia, they wasn't the ones who forced these people up against the wall to come up with saying that, well, we're going to give them life in prison without the possibility of parole. We're not going to kill them, although they campaigned 30 years unrelentlessly that they're going to kill Mumia. It's not that all of a sudden they feel as though, well, this is the right thing to do, or like Seth Williams said, that they spend so much money on this case. I'm saying this has heightened the demonstrations for Mumia. Just like when Rizzo attacked MOVE in 1978, he said, so ends the MOVE organization, and we can go into Cuba and invade Cuba and win if we wanted to. Well, we're still here, and we're at the forefront of this demonstration. Rizzo is dead, but those tactics that he's been using is still here, and we are still victorious because, again, this movement has slapped them down, making them back down off of their position into a position where they're trying to sneakily kill Mumia. And what we're saying, we be damned if we're going to allow that to happen as well. We expose them around the world. Already people from around the world have been responding to our emails and are letting them know of this devious trick and all this assassination attempt of Mumia's life.
Supporters of Mumia Abu-Jamal held a huge event in Philadelphia's Constitution Hall last week. In Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia, an international panel of jurists found former President George Bush and former British Prime Minister Tony Blair guilty of crimes against peace in the invasion of Iraq. Cynthia McKinney, the former Georgia congresswoman and Green Party presidential candidate, was deeply involved in the proceedings, but the trial got almost no coverage from the U.S. news media.
That really is a pity because the proceedings in Kuala Lumpur were extraordinary. Of course, I have been involved with the Kuala Lumpur Committee to Criminalize War for about 6 years now, when they had their very first meetings, and it progressed from just a commission of inquiry at which I was asked to present. And from there, the commissioners then decided that given the information that they received, and this information came from people who were physically tortured. Everyone remembers the image of the gentleman with arms outstretched with the black hood over him and then the black blanket or whatever he was wearing standing on like a bucket. We had that gentleman there who talked about his torture. We had Muazzam Beg, who talked about his torture. And Muazzam Beg also described the screams and the cries that he heard. He was in Bagram in Afghanistan. We heard from Sami Al-Haj, who was the Al Jazeera journalist who was picked up by the U.S. forces and sent to Guantanamo Bay, where he stayed for 6 years, 6 years, all because he was a journalist. And the Americans asked him, what are you going to do when you get out? And he said he was going to tell the truth. And so they never let him out. They kept him in. So we heard from all of these witnesses and victims who had tremendous stories of pain and abuse to tell about what their experiences were. When they gave their testimony, there was really no choice for the commission but then to charge a panel of seasoned, experienced international jurists with the opportunity to put together a tribunal using evidence at the court level. So there was nothing that was admitted at the tribunal that would not be admitted in a court of law. What just happened in Kuala Lumpur was that we actually were witnessing the trial itself. It was specific to the decision to go to war against Iraq. And that's why it was only Bush and Blair. But that was only charge one. Now, charge two is going to have to do with the matter of the individuals who were tortured by the decisions of these two heads of state who chose to commit what in international law is the highest crime, and that is a crime against the peace. In charge two, we will hear from those victims again. And this panel of judges will receive their direct testimony once again. So Kuala Lumpur is going to be the site of riveting testimony in about 6 months, I believe, is how long it will take them to raise the money to get this off the ground. But the whole watchword, I think, of what this effort in Kuala Lumpur is about is accountability. Needless to say that if we in this country were able to unite against all wars, then perhaps people in other parts of the world would not have these tremendously heroic yet tragic stories to tell.
And of course, the crime against peace was what many Nazis were executed for after the trials at Nuremberg.
That's exactly correct. And it is from Nuremberg that we get in this hierarchy of international crimes that the crime against the peace sits at the top.
President Obama, in one of his first acts as president, said that he would take no action against Bush and Cheney because of their illegal war against Iraq. I suppose that was so he won't be held accountable for his illegal wars, including the war against Libya.
Well, here's the thing that is really, really, I think, amounts to one of the highest betrayals that took place during the 2008 presidential campaign that sort of hoisted up our current president on this theme of hope and change. And people really were hoping for change. And then in 2009, after the swearing in, when a decision was made at the Justice Department that they would not support actions that had been filed to bring to court Bush and members of the Bush administration on various charges of torture and war crimes, but that they would indeed fight, use the energy and the resources of the Department of Justice to fight justice being meted out to someone who committed among the highest crimes that exist.
The United Nations, which was complicit in the assault on Libya, now reports that there are at least 7,000 political prisoners who are held without charge. Most of them are black. In a very perverse way, they might be considered the lucky ones in Libya, where mass killings have taken place and disappearances on a huge scale. How accountable for that should President Obama be held?
What we've seen is the complete destruction of a country. Now, what Kuala Lumpur was all about was Iraq. But now we have seen the Iraqization of Libya because certain individuals have been targeted. You've got rampant lawlessness. And in fact, I would say that it's worse than the situation that prevails in Iraq, although Iraq sustained a tremendous blow. I would almost suggest that at this particular point in time, it is not just the Iraqization of a country, but it is the Somalization of a country, because now we all remember that the choice of the people of Somalia for a government was not acceptable to those people who, you know, have decided that they can determine the governments of other people. And Somalia was basically governmentless for years. And so now I just read a United Nations news report that is discussing the weariness of the donor community and their reticence to give to Libya, because Libya actually has a lot of money. It has the financial wherewithal to pay for the problems, the humanitarian disaster that exists there now. And so people aren't, these countries, member states, are not giving. However, the problem is that the money has been ripped off. And so, therefore, the Libyan people are complaining that they haven't gotten anything. Nothing has trickled down to them. And, of course, the resistance is still alive and well. And so they're still fighting. They're still fighting it. And Libya is not on the front pages, and it's not at the top of the news hour any longer, but the people are still struggling to maintain a vestige of what they had.
Putting aside the criminality for a second of NATO, including the United States, regarding Libya, we hear not a peep from African governments whose nationals are still being held and detained and have been disappeared in Libya. What does the word accountability mean on that score with African governments?
Well, the African governments are less and less accountable to their own people. And it's interesting that the titular head of the Kuala Lumpur War Crimes Tribunal, that would be the former Prime Minister of Malaysia, Tun Dr. Mahathir, sent a letter to Tanzania because George W. Bush is actually doing an Africa swing and was asking that they exact some justice. And it's interesting that someone like George W. Bush, with all of the crimes that have been committed under his watch, can skip around the world and receive huge speaking fees, yet African heads of state are summarily hauled before the International Criminal Court as if there's nothing that exists on the African continent except minerals that other people want to steal and crooks.
And yet there seems to be no prospect of the crimes that have been committed against Libyan citizens, black Libyans, and nationals of other African nations. No hint of an ICC indictment against the U.S. allies in Libya.
This is very interesting. I was also recently in Cape Town, South Africa, because I also participate on the Bertrand Russell Tribunal on Palestine. And there we were looking at and receiving testimony from experts who experienced apartheid. So we were looking at the features of the government of Israel and its administration, both inside Israel as well as over the occupied Palestinian territories, and its treatment of the Palestinians, and comparing that with what the South Africans went through with apartheid. And the Bertrand Russell Tribunal found that indeed the state of Israel practices its own unique form of apartheid. Now, when we were there for those proceedings, there was a strike going on. In fact, there was a national strike in South Africa, and we just remember that President of South Africa, Jacob Zuma, instructed his United Nations ambassador to support the United States for the NATO action against the Libyan people. And I say that to say that there have been demonstrations held by the Africans in South Africa, in Ghana. We have seen demonstrations where Africans were so moved by the barbarity of what happened in Libya, aside from the fact that Libya was an engine that was driving what little hope for change existed on the African continent was being driven by Libya. And with that action, all of the hopes of these Africans for independence and standing up and justice finally were also dashed. And it was true that the grassroots Africans understood what they had lost and what was happening to them, even as their governments sold them out.
Literally millions of sub-Saharan Africans were affected directly by the events in Libya. And as you say, Colonel Gaddafi was well thought of in Black Africa. So what does this mean in terms of these governments which have failed to protest the atrocities in Libya?
I think that what Libya demonstrates is that there is a huge space. There's a lot of daylight between the hopes and aspirations of the peoples of Africa and of their imposed African leadership. And, you know, you can talk about, well, this one was democratically elected and that one was democratically elected. But at the end of the day, when you've got National Endowment for Democracy sticking its nose into the affairs of African states and able to offer millions of dollars to people to toe the U.S. line, then I guarantee you that democracy is diminished in very much the same way that democracy is diminished in this country when you have an election and the victor, 9 times out of 10, is the one who has the most money. Not the best ideas, but the most money.
The United States Congress took a giant step forwards towards preventive detention. In principle, President Obama has endorsed preventive detention of American citizens under certain circumstances.
Here's the thing. We've got journalists in Libya who were tweeting civilian targets into NATO for bombing. So what happens to a group of people who decide that they want to go and see the truth and report the truth, true journalists, and they could end up like Samuel Hodge, 6 years in detention for nothing, just because you were there to tell the truth. I remember not too very long ago when Nelson Mandela was coming to the United States, and all kinds of hoops had to be jumped through in order to facilitate his visit because he was on the terrorist list. So who would they put on the terrorist list tomorrow or today on the list of people to be indefinitely detained? It could be you, it could be me, it could be the young people of Occupy. It could be anyone who dares to dissent. And dissent demonstrates the strength of this country, how it treats those who dissent.
Cynthia McKinney, the former presidential candidate. In Newark, New Jersey, hundreds turned out in the rain for a march and rally called by the People's Organization for Progress, which has been holding daily demonstrations since June for jobs, adequate housing, education, justice, and peace. Newark City Councilman Ross Baraka was there. He said the Prudential Insurance Corporation, with headquarters in Newark, isn't paying its taxes.
They have had abatements for years, and they have not paid their taxes. They have not paid Newark a fair share. This is a $1 billion corporation. They don't need any tax breaks. What they need to be doing, actually, is helping the city and its residents and working people maintain a decent quality of life. They're sitting in the city while we are laying off police officers, sanitation workers, code enforcement officers. The school system is losing teachers. There's chaos in the city for lack of resources and money, and they're sitting on all of the resources and money and actually almost live in the city for free, relatively speaking. They obviously have the means to do more and should be demanded to do more.
Black America is facing an extreme economic crisis, but what about our political crisis? Are we politically prepared to defend ourselves at this time of economic catastrophe?
I don't know if we are. We've always been able to maintain and push forward. I think the Black America is in the same situation as most of America is now. It's just Black people get it a little worse disproportionately. You know, we get it worse because we are Black. So I think economically America is in bad shape. And doesn't seem to be anything on the horizon that suggests that we're going to get out of this condition any sooner. And its effect on our community is always a double. So the unemployment for African Americans is twice that of white Americans. So it devastates us. We see the level of underdevelopment in our neighborhoods, people getting laid off by, you know, the dozens. And so that affects families and creates the kind of depression and crime in our communities. And we need strong leadership. And at this point, you know, I would say American government is turned into more into like a corporate state. Before, the corporations used to influence government. Now they're just running their own people for office, right out of the boardroom themselves. You know, African Americans who are not fitting that mold, the new kind of right wing or right middle kind of mold of politics, are being pushed aside and characterized as old. You know, to have a civil rights agenda, they associate you with being outdated, involved in protest politics, as opposed to the kind of boardroom market ideology that they want these new politicians to have. If you look at these new African-American politicians, they fit that mold. And if you don't fit that mold, then you don't get the kind of support from these big money corporations. And we And one thing that we've done wrong is when we moved from these kind of cultural nationalist and nationalist kind of organizations and moved into politics and other kind of ideologies, we lost that cultural, political, and social organization that we used to have, those organizations that went out there and registered people to vote, that organized people, that fed people, that did African dance classes, that taught kids literacy, that did all those kinds of social programs in our neighborhoods and in our churches that helped us have a hard, strong political base. I think those organizations suffered when we began to turn to black politics and we put our faith and individual political leaders as opposed in these kind of social and political organizations that existed in our communities. As a result, those kind of organizations are gone, or at least have been marginalized to the point they don't have enough energy and power as they once did.
And of course, there's no substitute for the politics of the street, like POP is pushing.
Right, but that goes along with the whole agenda idea that the kind of protest politics is played out, or that it doesn't garner any results, which is completely ahistorical in the first place. It kind of almost flies in the face of everything that we've ever been able to do in this community or in this country. For that matter, has always been centered around our ability to organize, to protest, to march, to sit in, to speak out, to do those various things, to organize and mobilize our community and develop institutions as a result of it. And so for people to say that that no longer is relevant is actually ahistorical. And also, is almost contrary to what's happening around the world. And around the world, everybody else has actually adopted that kind of policy and are doing it in the streets all over the world, protesting these kind of economic and social policies that are draconian and against working people all over the world. And they're telling us right here in the U.S., a known strategy that we used for decades to no longer use, to abandon that, to go for a different kind of politics. And I think that is a desire to disarm us and disempower us.
Well, have we been disarmed and disempowered? In 2008 was the first election in my memory in which organized black America made no particular demands.
Right. Well, and I think that was specifically centered around the fact that we were happy with, we had a black face. We were so elated and overwhelmed by that. We put our guard down, and we really should have been prepared for that politically, because around the nation, we have black elected officials all over the place who have not, you know, stepped up to the plate or been able to organize or do the things that we need them to do. So I think that not only that is that an issue, but it's also an issue that we let our troops go home. So after the pro-democratic forces and anti-racist forces that put Barack Obama in power, once they did that, they thought that that was the end. And so once they reached the goal, everybody walked away from the fight. And in the meanwhile, the other people who we were fighting against began to gain ground, i.e. the Tea Party and all kinds of other organizations that are existing and attacked on not only just Barack Obama as an individual, but any kind of idea of any progressive kind of push in the left or any other kind of direction has been completely attacked and dismantled. So now you have Barack Obama who is halfway pushing programs, half-hearted and not going all the way, and appearing to be wishy-washy on domestic issues because he has not taken, you know, his policies to his logical end and is settling for these kind of middle-of-the-road ideas and compromises, which ultimately disempowers us, our community further, and most Americans for that matter. And part of that is him buckling, but the other part of it is our inability as a community to maintain the organization that ushered them into power in the first place and have some very clear demands, like you said, in terms of what we want as a result of having an African-American president.
Is Pop's daily regimen of demonstrations encouraging to you in terms of rebuilding black grassroots political institutions?
It's hopeful in that there are people who are still willing to take our message and movement to that level and are still committed to do that at that capacity. What we have to do is begin to organize and get more people involved and get the word out. And even if there's not everybody standing on a street corner, that they know what's going on and that they support it. The movement was never about a bunch of all of the African American community supporting or being involved in the marches, but they, you know, we have to support it from where we are. And that's up to other organizations and institutions to get the information out and the word out and get them to support what they're doing. So it is hopeful for me.
Newark City Councilman Ross Baraka, the People's Organization for Progress vows to keep up its daily protests for 381 days, the duration of the 1955 Montgomery bus boycott. It's already past the 160-day mark. Occupy Wall Street and many of its partners in the New Bottom Line movement held actions last week under the theme Occupy Our Homes. New York Communities for Change launched a campaign to reclaim houses that banks leave vacant and to defend against further foreclosures. Amelia Adams is the group's political and legal director.
New York Communities for Change for these past couple of years has been organizing in that particular neighborhood as well as throughout the state. In East New York, we've been working with families who are facing foreclosure. And as another fold to this campaign, individuals who live in severely over-leveraged buildings that are not getting any repairs done. The goal is to actually liberate a house that's just being vacant, sitting there, a bank-owned property that is just sitting there attracting crime, and moving in a family that's actually who wants to maintain it and be part of a neighborhood. There's two ways of actually doing it, because we are working in coalition with a number of groups. One is like a public showdown, and the other side of it is actually secretly moving in people to create residency and long-term, because it's actually harder to actually kick someone out once they've been squatting and established residency inside of a property.
Many people, when they think of foreclosures, they think of single-family homes that the families live in. But you're talking mm-hmm. about over-leveraged apartment buildings. These are issues mm-hmm. that affect renters. Could you explain?
Yeah. Several of New York City Council members held a press conference to actually call on these banks to turn over their vacant properties, whether they are multi-unit or single or two-family homes, and turn them over to a nonprofit that actually going to maintain it and provide affordable housing. In a situation with over-leveraged houses, they were like speculative real estate ventures that people got involved in, and there's no money to actually maintain the building, so they were just pretty much trying to milk how much they can get out and just leave the property. Often in these buildings, tenants cannot get repairs done because all they're doing is collecting the rent money and pretty much pocketing it. Often the elevator doesn't work. If there's an elevator in the building, there's an outdated boiler, because each time these over-leveraged buildings in that situation, it just goes from one landlord to the next, to the next, to the next, and with no intent to actually bring it up to a livable condition. So we're looking at that, and we're looking at vacant foreclosed properties.
One would think in a civilized country, when apartment buildings are not being kept up by predatory landlords, that the city would have an obligation to take over those buildings and then hand them over to those, including tenants, who could keep them up.
However, it's not happening. It does happen very rarely. I know New York City has done in the past successful third-party transfers. However, it hasn't happened widespread enough, because there's still so many vacant properties, multi-family properties. There's even stalled developments that are just empty and sitting there, and close hazards as well. And I think because of the public action, it's actually going to create the space to actually have this dialogue and also work towards, maybe we should actually look into initiating some more of these third-party transfers to nonprofits who are going to actually do something about it.
Now, we know that in New York especially, many of these buildings are, as you say, over-leveraged. That means the landlords mm-hmm. borrowed an excess of money because they planned to throw out, somehow evict the tenants who were already there, Black and Latino tenants.
That's often the case. And NYCC, New York Communities for Change, does that on a daily basis. I can't begin to tell you how many calls we get from tenants who they're calling 301, and actually one of the options is actually, you know what, maybe you should contact a group like NYCC. Then we'll go into the building and see that it's in a horrible condition. Some of these landlords should be taken to jail for the conditions that they are living in. And it's actually the work that we do to organize the tenants to come together and reach out to the people who can better their situations, whether it's the elected officials and putting more pressure on the city to do something about this. And it's that ground organizing that's actually going to make something happen with the collaboration with our electeds.
Amelia Adams of the New York Communities for Change. In Minneapolis, Minnesota, the local Occupy movement joined up with Neighborhoods for Change to camp out in the homes of two families facing imminent loss of their homes. Monique White bought her house in 2003, the first member of her family to own a home, but the bank is trying to put her out.
I have been at my job for over 11 years and due to budget cuts, over 2,000 people lost their jobs, including myself. And at that point, I had been in touch with U.S. Bank trying to see if I qualify for the Obama program, making it affordable for homeowners to stay in their homes. And I thought I had fit the criteria just because it said if you had lost a certain amount of your income due to job loss or, you know, whatever. This program was for people like myself, and U.S. Bank pretty much gave me the runaround and said that I didn't qualify, and I didn't understand that.
So you did everything in your power to comply with these bankers' requests?
Yes, sir, I did.
You are aware that the Obama program has actually helped only a very small fraction of the people that the president said he was going to help?
Yes, I just found that out today, which I'm very appalled by that, because my thing is, if it only helped, what was it, 5% of people, who were those people? Were they rich people? Did it only apply to rich people, or was this across the board supposed to help everybody?
That was Monique White. Minneapolis Occupiers and Neighborhoods for Change are also camped out at the home of Bobby Hull, a Vietnam-era veteran. Mr. Hull's mother bought the house in 1968, but he found himself unable to work because of illness.
Bank of America, get me into these programs, you know, makes homes affordable, lower your interest, lower your payments, all this. And I applied for at least four of them. They would send me application after application. I'd get four or five applications in one day. Send this information back to them, and they could never find my information. When they did find my information, they didn't converse with me. They put me on a program, and 2 months later, they told me I was in default of the program, but they had never told me I was on the program. The next time, they didn't approve me. The final time, they were still trying to approve the program, but they let the sheriff's cell continue on. And so sheriff's cell went in that ended that program.
They could have delayed the sheriff's sale if they really wanted you to be in the program.
Yes, that's what I thought too.
Bobby Hull's house was sold at a sheriff's auction. Two federal communications commissioners called a public meeting in Atlanta last week to discuss the city's communications needs. The FCC commissioners got a message they might not have wanted to hear from community radio station WRFG, the Georgia Green Party, and the local Occupy movement. Black Agenda Report managing editor Bruce Dixon was there for the Green Party.
The transition from analog to digital TV freed up thousands of potential new channels and frequencies ideal for public municipal broadband and community-owned stations. Instead of handing these publicly owned frequencies back to communities and creating thousands of new not-for-profit community broadcasters, women and minorities, there goes your real diversity, the FCC is privatizing these precious and irreplaceable public properties by auctioning them off. So the number one thing a lot of us think should happen is the FCC ought to stop the frequency auctions and cease these privatizations. I want you to tell me why that can't be done. Number two, the FCC ought to give these frequencies back to the public, back to not-for-profit community broadcasters who will be glad to provide the access to local voices, the local news coverage, and the public service that community broadcasters have that commercial broadcasters have refused to provide us, like rappers who you never hear because they'll never get a Sony contract. Number three is, like Ms. Heather Gray said, make the commercial broadcasters and cable operators pay for the cost of community broadcasting. They're making trillions of dollars off scarce public resources. That is the spectrum. They need to pay for that. At this point, mic check. Here it is. Stop the privatizations.
Stop the privatizations.
The frequencies belong to the people.
The frequencies belong to the people.
Create new and diverse community broadcasters.
Create new and diverse community broadcasters.
By giving the people back their spectrum.
By giving the people back their spectrum.
Make the commercial broadcasters and cable operators.
Make the commercial broadcasters and cable operators.
Pay for the scarce public resources they use. By funding community broadcasting. Thank you.
Bruce Dixon and other activists in Atlanta. In an election that few think was fair, Joseph Kabila was the winner of another term as president of the Democratic Republic of Congo. We spoke with Kambale Musavuli of Friends of the Congo in Washington. He said the fix has been in for nearly a year.
Oh, yes, yes. Some of us will be watching this election. Since the beginning of the year, we have raised the flag. Whenever the constitution of the Congo was amended, there were amendments into the constitution, specifically also the change in the electoral law. One of them being removing the second round of elections and having only one round of election. The government gave the reason of keeping one round of the election is that it costs too much money to have two rounds of elections. So that was the stated reason. And this was passed into our parliament. You know, the parliament of the Congo has a majority, the political party called PPRD, which is the president's political party. So that's why they changed that. You know, I wanted to share in like how we got to where we are today. You know, one was the change of the constitution. The second is the constitution change, right? Maybe that the governors of provinces, they are appointed or fired by the president. The third change that they made was that he gave the president the power to appoint the judges at the Supreme Court. So he appointed the governor for Katanga, for example. This is one of the major states, and I voted at 90% for him, if I remember correctly, when he was a 60% counted. When I'm speaking about the judges, why is it critical? No, right now, after the election results is published, the opposition can enter a request for contesting the elections. But he appointed just 18 judges. You know, so you can already see how that's going to go if anyone contests legally the results. So seeing that dynamic, right, he prepared from a legal perspective to try to prove to the international community I won it legally. But now here's the twist. The Congolese people are hungry for change. So what has been unfolding for the past months is something the international community did not expect. Now, I must say this. Kabila is supported by the United States. I know that for sure because we're witnessing the language of the United States with the current actions. Remind me of what the U.S. was saying about Mubarak. The posting the condemnation letter, we are requiring that the Congolese government protect the civilians. A statement is a statement. A bold action is a bold action. We know what a bold action looks like. We saw it. Whenever you show up in Libya, that's a bold action. So a letter of statement on the State Department website is just a statement. So my emphasis is more so the Congolese people's participation. There was one of the opposition leaders who has a lot of clout. It changed his security. As he came into the picture, the West actually, I think, they underestimated him. They did not believe that Congolese on the ground will rally behind him. So he does have the majority of the support of the people. So whenever we see, we see the population rallying behind him and seeing the result as it comes out in certain key states, the states are given to Kabila, the many irregularities in the ballot, you know, the ballot stuffing, the only news media, this is actually interesting, there were reports by Congolese of ballot stuffing. Pictures were circulating amongst Congolese, in Congolese communities. The only international media that actually looked at this issue is Al Jazeera. And that was the reporter called Yvonne Ndenge. She's based in Nigeria. But she covered it. She was on the ground. She even had on the program the cards, the registration card of one individual with five different names. You can see five cards, same person with five names. She showed the pictures of the ballot stuffed. So, and I asked myself, how is it that in this time with all the international journalists on the ground, the only person who's able to actually have an analysis on the staff ballot is Al Jazeera. What happened to the other journalists? How come they never even brought it up? And here and there, you will see statements from the international community. There are reports of irregularities. But what are they, those irregularities? We saw how the opposition parties were stopped from their rallies, not given permits to organize. Well, anytime the posters are posted in Kinshasa in certain areas, the police took it down. Not only that, on November 26th, in front of international journalists, international media, peaceful protesters were shot at with live bullets, live ammunition by the Congolese police. And all people have to do is just go on YouTube, type in election violence, November 26th. So the video wasn't even snuck out. These are video for it. Euronews and Al Jazeera, you see that? No, it was recorded. But there hasn't been no bold action. What has taken place has been interesting. The ICC literally, you know, from our perspective, is that the ICC is intimidating the opposition, giving them a warning for election violence.
We see this article that quotes Luis Moreno Ocampo as saying, warning that violence is no longer a ticket to power. He assures them it is a ticket to The Hague. But it seems that cheating in the voting process can be a ticket to power. But if you protest it, you might go to The Hague.
Exactly. And that's something that Congolese are very clear about. When we saw that, we ask ourselves, we have the images of civilians being shot. And our constitution, the Congolese constitution, gives the power to the Congolese people to protest against a regime that works against them. Just as the American constitution gives the Americans the power to protest against their own government if the government does not work against the interests of the people. So the self-determination of the Congolese people is being challenged with a warning from Luis Moreno Ocampo, don't go too far out of the plantation. That's the way I look at it. So wait a minute, this is our country that the people have spoken. You know, me even trying to speak from a nonpartisan way, I have to denounce this, that it does not make sense that they will condemn the opposition while we have information of the current regime, right? Current regime oppressing the people, not even improving the conditions of the lives of the Congolese people. The women are being raped in the East. We have not seen the stop of that. No condemnation for the Congolese government for not stopping the violence in the Congo. Not only that, the street children of Kinshasa have been all taken off the street and put in police camps. No one is denouncing that the freedom of the people, their rights are being stripped. But condemnation is there. But again, as I said earlier, it is critical for people to know that the international community did not expect Congolese to raise their voice in the mix of all of this. So we've seen protests all around the world, in South Africa, in Paris, in Washington, in Sweden, right? There is one also that took place in Brussels, in Senegal. The Congolese are actually occupying embassies. They occupied the Congolese embassy in Paris. I mean, that was amazing to see that young Congolese speaking outside of the Congo, denouncing the international community support of the current regime. When we feel that the voice of the people is not heard, so now irregularities, of course, can be challenged by the international community or the current regime. But what we know is the people themselves have the result. And there is no condemnation for the international community to stop that, but all for the international community are coming at the side of the Congolese as they try to rise for their own self-determination.
Now, given this militancy on the part of the Congolese people and the fact that Kabila has won with a minority of the vote and maybe a much smaller minority than the official tallies say, what does this augur for the state of Congolese politics in the months and weeks to come?
Well, it's really not up to the international community to decide the fate of the Congolese people. It's really up to themselves. You know, when one look at what took place in Egypt, the international community was not in support of the Egyptian in the struggle to remove Mubarak. Mubarak won the election, by the way. The Egyptian people organized to make sure that the voice were heard all around the world. That's not what the Congolese have to do. You know, I'm speaking to young Congolese here in this country and from overseas and letting them know, even if Kabila becomes a winner, that does not mean that's the end. Because Kabila is not supported with $2 billion a year as Mubarak was supported. So we Congolese can organize to make sure that we really achieve the independence that Patrice Lumumba dreamed of in 1960. And that will come as we organize to do so. We are having allies, specifically even having American allies, because American allies can put pressure on the government to stop the support of Joseph Kabila. If Americans are not telling Hillary Clinton, why are we supporting these people? They will continue to do it because you know what? They don't expect Americans to give them a phone call about the Congo. I said, what? Congo Americans don't care about the Congo. We've heard that so many times from American diplomats. But the moment the American people start connecting with Congolese, just as they did in 1960, Elombe Braff connected with Lumumba. Where are the Elombe Braff for today? To connect with the Congolese, to speak for the Congolese people. You know, that, and that's what needs to happen. Same thing with Malcolm X. You know, he didn't travel to the Congo, but every opportunity he had to bring the situation of the Congo to the American people, he did. If you can understand what's happening in Mississippi, you can understand what's happening in the Congo. Mobilizing people in this country to understand the struggle of Africa and the importance of the Congo. And that's how we look at it. No matter what the international community say, it's really up to the Congolese people. And the better they organize, the stronger they become, the harder it is for the international community to continue to dictate the future of the Congo.
Kambale Musavuli of Friends of the Congo. Our friend and colleague Jared Ball, columnist for Black Agenda Report, has some advice for the politically aware moviegoer. Stay away from the Clint Eastwood-directed film J. Edgar.
J. Edgar, the new film by Clint Eastwood, is a real horror film. It is an act of violence, an act of terrorism. The film's careful construction of FBI founding father J. Edgar Hoover as a flawed but justifiable hero, rather than an individual villain performing the tasks of a villainous institution, has hit theaters with the precision timing of a Predator drone strike and with similar political design. As old antagonisms produce new and threatening responses, as new generations emerge taking their turn asking serious questions about the planet, equality, justice, and self-determination, be they occupiers or decolonizers, Hoover returns even in death to remind the liberal, the affluent, the white that their place atop the social pyramid is legitimate and must be protected by any means necessary. And no matter what they say, they love him for it. And that is why so much of the discussion surrounding the film has focused on its award-worthy acting or Hoover's sex life. A willful ignorance allows such a political monstrosity to be admired. From the beginning, Hoover is cast positively as a much-needed and tough organizer of law enforcement, a protege of Attorney General Palmer's raids against the violent radical terrorists of their day. And true to the form and function of mainstream media, those dissidents are given no context, description, or honest reflection. The Bolsheviks, anarchists, and labor movement activists are barely mentioned and only at all to give Hoover legitimacy in his own desire to catalog and monitor every citizen and then to deport, falsely imprison, or assassinate those he deems threats to national security. And, of course, only their violence is real violence. Certainly the violence of capital exploitation and imperial wars are not called into question. No. Only the actions of enemies are questionable. What ultimately stands unchallenged is the righteous attempt, even if imperfectly executed, of the state and Hoover to bring order to police work and to a society destined by the divine to be supremely white and capitalist. So for white radicals, the film has only brief mention and dismissal. Black activists don't even appear. But why should they? The white radicals, like Emma Goldman, only briefly hit the screen to justify today's hostility to immigrants and so-called anti-terrorism campaigns. Goldman's on-screen deportation and the only passing reference to the assassinated anarchists Sacco and Vanzetti, who are never mentioned by name, only as the two Italians, serve only to convey legitimacy to Hoover in the past and the targeted killings, detentions, and anti-immigration policies of the present. Deport those you cannot kill. That completed, there is no need then to even reference, for instance, Hubert Henry Harrison or Marcus Garvey, both of whom were early targets of Hoover and called by him race pimps and notorious Negro agitators. And because of an otherwise inexplicable need of this film to dwell on the mundane aspects of Hoover's career, the film allows itself to simply run out of time. So countless minutes spent on the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, without any discussion of Charles Lindbergh's beliefs in eugenics and Nazism, along with an intimate look at Hoover's personal life with his mother and his male companion, assure that we get nothing of his concern over the Black Panther Party or the surveillance and deportation of people like Claudia Jones and C.L.R. James, or culpability in the killings of, say, Malcolm X and Fred Hampton, to name but a few. Dr. King only appears as pornographic background, his politics and assassination apparently irrelevant. And the word counterintelligence is mentioned in the film only once, but not as Hoover's counterintelligence program, and certainly with no discussion of that program's continued impact. So therefore, no mention could then be made of Hoover's direct involvement in framing Black radicals for crimes they did not commit, but for which some still suffer incarceration right now in 2011. Particularly at a time of expanded police and military power and the deep charm of an imperial president, this film reads as a violent assault against history meant to terrorize today's audiences by reinforcing either an irrational fear of the state or an equally irrational justification for what the state does out of self-preservation. It is no mere historical drama. It is a blatant warning for today. Immigrants and radicals are to be monitored, deported, killed, or imprisoned, and it is all for the greater good that is the United States.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black Left. I'm Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Greg Russ.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.